What about the voicemail? The one from the woman calling herself Annie. She exhaled, gathering her handbag back to her chest. I don't know what to think about it. A prank call, maybe? But the timing. Yeah, I know. It's really bizarre she called right after Paul took off. She glanced out the window and then at the watch on her small wrist. Really bizarre. She shifted in her seat, making evident her patience was stretching. Coincidences do happen, though. All the time. One last question, Charlotte. I can't count on Joanna for straight answers, and your sister seems too broken up to even consider the possibility. Do you think Paul was having an affair? Maybe with this woman, Annie? No, she answered, eyes lingering on mine. I've never suspected Paul of an affair, and I'd know. I slept next to an adulterer for years. Charlotte dropped her purse on the table with a heavy thud that screamed our conversation was over. Excuse me, detective. Busy day. Kids, she said, and exited the cafe. As the door swung closed behind her, I began processing our discussion. Leaning back in my chair, I folded my arms. I didn't believe Charlotte had been lying about anything she'd said. She never broke eye contact during her answers. Her jawline never even tensed. The only nervous fidgeting came when she discussed the state of her sister, but that simply indicated sincerity. Telling me how drunk Gray had been made her uncomfortable. When it came to her older sister, discussing matters that could be framed as disparaging wasn't easy for her. Most importantly, I'd verified Gray's condition on the night in question. She'd been too intoxicated to carry out any sort of crime resulting in Paul's disappearance. He weighed twice what she did and had been stone cold sober, at least according to Charlotte. Then there's the voicemail, Annie's message. Gray could have called herself from another phone to throw off suspicion. The thought had crossed my mind, but the desperation in Gray's voice, the frantic search for answers in her eyes as she played the message for me, that was real. I didn't believe that she'd called herself to muddy the waters. Charlotte's theory, too, had some weight to it. A drunk wife was an easy target for a guy like Paul. But he was too smart and had too much on the line to trust himself around her. Instead of striking Gray out of jealousy, he might have extricated himself from the situation. Worried over what he would do if he spent any more time with Gray than he absolutely had to, he might have even left his luggage behind. It was certainly a possibility. Back at the station, Sammy found me at my desk, poring through my interview notes from Gray and Joanna. Any luck getting contacts for the other folks at Ruby's? He asked, pulling up a swivel chair from the next cubicle over. I've scheduled sit-downs with Jacob and Francis. We've got a police record for an Elizabeth local named Jonas Hatfield. Disorderly conduct 2 years ago, and public intoxication last spring. I've left him a message to get back in touch. Aunt Annie, whoever the hell she is? I sighed. Whoever the hell she is sounds like the right sentiment. No luck. No leads. We just have to hope she reaches out again. How'd coffee with the sister go? Okay, I answered. No new information beyond what Gray and her mother already told us. Charlotte was ashamed to speak about Gray's intoxication, so at least that's verified. Didn't suspect Paul of an affair either. Speaking of, he started, shifting his weight in the squeaking chair, I've found some unusual stuff on Mr. Godfrey. Oh, I said, meeting his eyes. What sort of stuff? Well, debts. A startling amount of debt for somebody so well off. Sometimes folks who look rich are just MasterCard rich. Remember Greg Whitman of Whitman Autos? I reminded him. I remember, he replied. Just given his connection to the King family, it's a bit surprising is all. Extensive debts. Go on. I put my interview notes back in a manila folder and pushed it away. Sammy leaned forward in his chair, elbows resting on his knees. Well, for starters, he apparently has a bank account Gray ain't privy to. Gray gave me a list of their accounts. She was absolutely certain it was exhaustive. Of course, well-executed lies inspire confidence in others, especially spouses. She didn't include it in her disclosure. He pulled a flip pad from his back pocket and began to tick through his notes. She gave us the joint checking and savings, and the Charleston firm holding her trust. A whopper of a trust, mind you. Three credit cards, all in her name, with him listed as an authorized user. Not surprising after seeing his credit score, but she never mentioned Paul's Navy Union account. Paul never served. How'd he acquire a service member account? His late father was a naval airman, fought in Korea, I think. That makes Paul eligible for Navy Union banking. That's the account the government garnishes his wages from. Wait, Paul's wages are garnished? I narrowed my eyes. Yeah. And he does some accounting sleight of hand to keep Gray in the dark. His salary is direct deposited into two accounts, their joint checking and the credit union account, where Uncle Sam takes a slice back for the student loans he defaulted on. That's unusual. How and when did he default on student loans? It turns out Paul lived the high life well before he married into the King family. Lavish dinners, $300 bar tabs on a regular basis. Get this, as a law student, he shelled out almost $2,000 a month in rent. All from student loans he didn't pay back. Are you kidding me? That honking diamond Gray sports? Another loan. $60,000 borrowed against their D.C. townhome. Possibly fraudulent since only Mrs. Godfrey's name is on the title, and the cash was dispersed into an account she doesn't know exists. Another thought struck me. Or does she know it exists? Maybe she lied to us. What would her motive be? Sammy asked. What's the single thing the entire family, Paul, Gray, Charlotte, especially Joanna, is preoccupied with more than anything else? Sammy thought for a moment, answered, appearances. If Paul's hiding debt, Gray might not know or she might not want us to know. She may not have even tipped Paul off that she was onto his money moving. Easiest way to maintain a lie is to tell as few folks as possible. Same for a crime, Sammy added. Regardless whether she knowingly or unknowingly bought her own ring, this doesn't make sense. If Paul's hiding debt, why would he run off from a wife who just so happens to be, a shipping heiress? Sammy ran his hand through his hair. No idea, especially since his name is on the trust, too. He's entitled to half of it if they divorce, so long as he doesn't cheat. And half of it ain't nothing to balk at. He gets it all if he outlives Gray. I thought about that for a moment. South Carolina marriage laws are antiquated, often filled with all kinds of morality clauses. Paul gets half of the trust if they divorced. But if he was unfaithful, he'd forfeit the whole thing. If he and Annie were engaged in an affair, he'd be under intense pressure not to let Gray find out. Pressure Annie might not feel so much or care about. Sammy interrupted my thoughts. other things don't add up, too.
What other things?
Well, his debts are bad, but they look paltry compared to the King Trust. I don't understand why they don't just pay them off in one lump sum from his wife's inheritance.
Sammy asked a perfectly normal question, but somebody ambitious like Paul Godfrey didn't operate under the same paradigm as normal folks. The more he gained, the more he had to lose, and the more one had to lose, the more warped his priorities became. I offered an explanation. If he rented a posh apartment as a broke law student, then Paul cares about appearances quite a bit. He didn't rack up those bar tabs drinking by himself. Bills like that come from buying rounds, and people buy rounds when they're flush with cash or want to look like they're flush with cash. Combine that with an upcoming run for office, and you've got somebody who would do everything he could to keep debts hidden, perhaps even from his own wife.
You mentioned the run for office, Sammy replied. Don't political parties vet potential candidates, especially for defaulting on something like a student loan? Hell, if that's not showing disregard for government, I don't know what is.
I chewed on the cap of my pen. The run hadn't been announced, but you're right. They would have requested financial disclosures from him, or at least they would have very soon. If Paul was cheating on Gray, he'd be under severe pressure to keep it quiet. And if he planned to run for Congress, he'd be under as much pressure to settle his debts.
None of it makes sense. His disappearing or running off or whatever. There's no narrative to any of it.
Sammy was right about that, too. None of it makes sense if Paul ran off.
And if he didn't?
Then he's missing for some other reason, and we need to know who stands to benefit from his absence.
14. Gray. Rain pelted the window like bullets, hard and fast. It turned out the afternoon sunshine had been nothing but a spiteful trick. The nightlight in my bedroom threw exaggerated shadows against the walls, sharp and violent. 3 days now. 3 days without a drop to drink, and the third night was always fucking hell. My sheets, soaked in sweat, twisted tighter around my legs as I turned from one side to the other over and over again. My phone sat face down on the nightstand. I couldn't bring myself to look at it. I had no interest in knowing how little sleep remained for claiming, assuming I even could. It had never been this bad before. Of course, there'd been the sleepless nights, but having Paul next to me had always provided an inch of comfort. That tiny comfort would have been like oxygen to the drowning woman I'd become. Now he was gone, maybe even missing, whatever that meant. The renewed separation anxiety compounded with my withdrawal, and my heart pounded away erratically in my chest. Sometimes it beat too slow, sometimes far too fast. Never like it should. And there was no way to stave it off. I'd stolen away to Mama's bathroom again, only to find the Valium removed from her cabinet. I should have grabbed more than a handful that first day. I was always so impulsive, never thinking down the road, never beyond the immediacy of the present. I had confirmed the wine cabinet had been locked, the same with the liquor in the dining room buffet. The police had the rental, and town was too distant to walk. No one, not Mama, not Cora, not even Charlotte, would lend me a car. I'd run out of fresh excuses to be dropped off in town alone. All day, the calls had been relentless, vapid messages from everyone that wasn't Paul or Annie. Friends of ours in D.C. sending me their thoughts and prayers. I could hear the hesitation tainting each well-intentioned message, the inevitable pause before reminding me to stay strong, not to let the circumstances of life get to me. I was unsure whether this referred to the affair they expected Paul of having or my drinking. It became harder to distinguish the two. To pull them apart and keep them in separate boxes in my mind was impossible. Maybe I wasn't as great at compartmentalizing as I thought. Nothing more from Annie. Paul's Annie. That's how I'd started to think of her. How long had it been going on? My memories of Paul hunched over his phone became more detailed. Now, when I recalled each instance of peculiar secrecy, I plainly saw the screen of his device. Now it read, Annie. Perhaps I'd die tonight. A heart attack or cardiac arrest or whatever happened to the hearts of drunks. I'd read online withdrawals from certain drugs, even the most dangerous ones like heroin, were almost never fatal. But drink? You can seize up and die. The culmination of delirium tremens, DTs, the worst sort of shakes. I'd used the threat of a seizure once as leverage in an argument with Paul. He'd come home from an overnight trip in Toronto to find me waking up from a particularly hard binge the day before. Whenever he left for business, I tended to overdo it, even for me, but I usually managed to clean myself, and the house, up before he returned. This time had been different. I'd been caught off guard. Purpled splotches of dried Cabernet spattered the kitchen sink, slung across the counter, and pooled in places on the floor like a sweet-smelling murder scene. A cadre of fruit flies danced on the rim of a half-emptied wine glass. A takeout box of pad thai spilled out onto the kitchen table, leaving greasy imprints from a late-night binge. The waking pain was unbearable, too severe to drive or walk to the liquor store. Too severe to do anything but drink. I could drink it away, if only he'd bring me something. "Do you want me to die, Paul?" I'd half screamed, half cried, when he'd confronted me in our darkened bedroom. Coffered ceilings and fermented air. "The store is just around the corner. One bottle of wine." "Look at yourself," he'd said, disgusted. He'd held the back of his hand to his nose as if the sight of me might make him vomit. "You've done nothing but drink since I left." "Please," I begged, my dry eyes stinging with fresh tears. "One bottle. If I can just get to sleep tonight, tomorrow I can start clean. I promise. I can't start over like this. I can't." His brow remained creased, but he relaxed his hands and knelt by our bed. "One bottle of wine." I coughed, running quaking fingers through my knotted hair. "If I have a seizure, I could die." "Jesus Christ, Gray," Paul whispered, stroking my wet cheek with the back of his hand. "What the hell is wrong with you? What are you running away from?" I began to shake all over. Maybe from my hangover, maybe from fear, probably an unhealthy mixture of both. But I didn't answer his question. He stood, collecting his car keys off the dresser. "One bottle," he relented. "You're not going to the hospital, I promise," he said with a small smile. I strained to take it for genuine caring, but I knew that the thought of an emergency room visit, and the publicity it'd invite, had been the real motivator. As he left our home for the liquor store, I lay back on my satin pillow. The shaking stopped. My body still ached, and an invisible vice tightened around my skull, but the trembling had vanished in an instant. The answer to his question had been simple. Perhaps the most obvious thing in my life. Myself. I was running away from myself. When I opened my eyes, I only heard stillness. I wiped my sticking eyelids, and daylight broke through. My cheeks stung. They felt creased from lying motionless across crinkled sheets for hours. Hours. I'd slept. I sprang for my phone. 10:15 a.m. I didn't care what time I'd finally drifted off. It no longer mattered. It could have been 3 in the morning, and I'd have still slept for 7 whole hours. And then I saw the missed call. Unknown. at 4:28 a.m. And the voicemail. Annie. Scrambling, I input my PIN and held my breath as I waited for the message to start. Should I be happy or terrified? She'd finally reached out again like she said she would. But why call so early? Here I was, sleeping away while vital information waited in my phone's mailbox. Her voice was a near whisper, lower than last time.
Hello, Gray.
It's me.
It's Annie. I'm so sorry to call at such a crazy hour, but I still want to talk to you about Paul. If it's possible, I'd like to meet with you.
My heart pounded in my chest as adrenaline bolted outwards through my arms and legs. Annie wanted to meet me.
Someplace private. What I have to say is very...
She hesitated.
Sensitive.
I wasn't sure what to think of that. Sensitive meant risky for Paul. But if taking unnecessary risks on Paul's behalf was something this woman was worried over, that likely meant Paul was okay. Annie continued.
The bistro on Oleander Avenue, the Italian place. Meet me there this afternoon at 1:30. Come alone. Don't notify anyone. Not your family, and certainly not the police.
Her voice lowered even further. I could barely make out what she said next.
This is incredibly sensitive, Gray. No one can know, or everything could be ruined. Paul's future bid, everything.
The message ended with a click as Annie hung up. Annie was in Elizabeth, and I was going to meet her. My worst fears began to erode as I reasoned through her message. She wasn't his mistress. She wasn't Paul's Annie. If she was, she'd have no reason to meet with me. And if she was afraid of harming Paul with whatever information she had, then Paul had to be alive, at least for now. She knew about his planned run for Congress. Maybe she worked at Cooper and Waters, too? What sort of information could Annie have? Worry over my last question disappeared in the wake of intense relief. I leapt to my suitcase, next to Paul's, still unpacked from my flight days earlier. So much had happened since then, but there wasn't time to dwell. I had to get dressed and ready, and then I had to find a way to get to the restaurant on Oleander Avenue.
I don't like the idea of this, Charlotte announced as she slid my cell phone back across the kitchen counter.
She'd just finished listening to Annie's voicemail. I picked it up and returned it to my bag next to my laptop. I haven't had a drop to drink in 4 days now. 4 days. And you know it's true. You've been with me every second of each one.
It's not that, she said, picking at her nails.
It's not just that.
Then what is it?
I asked, lowering my voice. Mama's footsteps echoed upstairs, and if she heard us arguing and became involved, my plan was shot.
You heard her. She has important information regarding Paul, and she told me to tell no one, to come alone. I wouldn't have said a word to you if I didn't need the car.
Charlotte crossed her arms. You know that's not what I meant, I replied, folding my own.
It's exactly what you meant. You ticked through a list of all the people at Piper Point with available cars and decided I'm the weakest link, the one who'd bend under pressure. That's not it at all, Charlotte. I...
Take a cab, she said tersely, casting her gaze over my shoulder to avoid mine. I strained to whisper now. With Mama around, this couldn't turn into a debate. It was far too important.
A taxi will leave a record and a witness, and you heard her yourself. The information she has could cost Paul the election. Paul seems to be doing a fine job of sinking his own chances with this mess.
Her eyes darted to the television in the den, and I was certain Bethany's news report was replaying in her mind.
Charlotte, my eyes widened. I need information. Any information. Annie has some, and she's willing to share it with me. I have to play by her rules.
I'm struggling here. I really am. I haven't had an ounce to drink. At a time like this?
The chance, you mean?
I nodded my brow.
What?
You haven't had the chance to drink at a time like this, she sighed. My phone indicated it was 12:30 already. Time slipped away with every moment we wasted talking in circles.
A few hours. I need it for a few hours.
I'll drop you off a couple blocks away. You can walk.
Why wasn't Charlotte understanding?
When her relationship with Will was collapsing, she'd called me almost daily, and unless I was worried about slurring, I always answered. I was a sounding board for her anger. But then again, was I really? How often had my drinking sent Charlotte's needs to voicemail? More than I cared to remember. Did she resent me for it now? I tried my best to remain calm, but desperation edged its way into my voice. She said to tell no one, not the detective, not my family. What if she sees me get out of the car with you in it? We have no idea where she'll be coming from or if she'll even be on time. I can't risk it. You heard Annie's first voicemail? Something frightened her from leaving her contact information. I'm lucky she reached out again. If we spook her now, what will I have? What will I do then? Charlotte unclenched her jaw and exhaled. She was starting to come around. I always knew when I'd begun to gain ground with her.
I said it wasn't just that. The car, I mean.
What else? I asked. She appeared uneasy, shifting her weight from one heel to the other and back again.
I understand. This woman claims to have sensitive information. But Nina explicitly said to notify her the moment Annie made contact again. Spooked or not, she predicted this would happen. I don't like the idea of keeping this from her. She knows more about handling these things than you and I. She's a detective, for Christ's sake.
I hadn't made up my mind on how much I trusted Nina yet. How could I when she'd delayed on coming to us over the rental? And with her family's history with ours? Besides, I wasn't going to keep her out. I just wanted to talk to Annie before she did. I didn't know who the woman was, and I didn't know what she knew. Both things I'd prefer to learn before Nina.
We can't tell her just yet, I answered. Not until after I've met Annie. I need to put a face to her name. I need to speak with her, to hear what she has to tell me.
Tears gathered in the corner of my eyes. I pressed on. I've had nothing to cling to these past few days. No information, no means of understanding why Paul took off.
Sure, there was the fight at the bar over Jacob, but this is something else. To vanish? To risk complications with work and his congressional bid? Something happened to him. We have problems, but this woman has answers I need before I can even think about Paul and me.
I know, but what you said isn't true. Her eyes at last returned to mine.
What do you mean?
That you've had nothing to cling to, she replied. That's not true. You've had me, Gray. You've had your sister. I forced a grin. Maybe she wasn't resentful.
Then don't take that away from me. A few hours, Charlotte. A few hours and it's right back home. Back to Piper Point.
Okay. Charlotte finally relented. The worry deep in her eyes overshadowed the tiny smile she sported.
A few hours and Mama can't know.
I'll think of some way to hide it from her.
15. Nina.
I've got Ms. Miles waiting for you in the fishbowl, the officer at reception informed me. Thank you, I answered, hanging up my desk phone. I took a deep breath before gathering my files and heading to the glassed-in conference room for the second time in the Godfrey King case. This could go any number of ways, but fun wasn't one of them. Hello, Ms. Miles, I smiled as the door clicked shut behind me. Nina, Frances said through a pearly grin. She sported a white sundress covered in a pattern of stitched crimson poinsettias. Cocking her head to one side like a playful kitten, she added, And please call me Frances. We're old friends, after all. Sure, I replied. Frances. She may have changed a thing or two over the years, but the look she wore remained the same. Vapid, filled with superiority. Even seated, she somehow managed to look down on me. It's just awful what happened. With Paul Godfrey, that is. It's been all over the news the past few days. Gray must be a wreck. I've left a few voicemails with their maid, Laura, I think. But I haven't heard back. Cora, I said, taking my seat across the table from her. She arched her brow. I'm sorry? Cora. Their housekeeper's name is Cora. You called her Laura. Oh, she pursed her lips. Well, you know more than I do about the family, it seems. Tell me then, how's Gray holding up? I brought you here to speak about the evening of Christmas Eve and the early hours of Christmas morning, I said, thumbing through the papers I'd laid out on the table. Something you certainly know more about than I, since you were there. With Paul and Gray and a few others, if I'm not mistaken. I was, she answered, her face turned quizzical. Do you think something bad happened to Paul? Like foul play? I found the blank legal pad I'd been searching for and uncapped my pen. Ms. Miles, Frances, I'd like you to tell me what happened that evening. Start to finish. She hesitated, clearly not used to having her questions go unanswered, certainly not by me. Well, let's see, she started. I ran into them at church. Blessed Lamb Baptist, correct? Correct, she replied. I wasn't expecting to see them. Neither of those girls comes home very often. It was quite a surprise. I'd begun to make notes. A good surprise? The question seemed to offend her. Of course. We were all very close friends growing up. But you drifted apart? I suppose you could say so, but I think it's more like Gray and her sister drifted away from Elizabeth, me and the rest of the town. Even Joanna King talked in church about how she'd raised daughters only to have them run off someplace else. At least Charlotte stayed in a Carolina, even if it was the wrong one. Gray went all the way to Washington. I tried my best to retain a smile. So, it was a reunion at church. Oh, yes. I promptly invited them out to Ruby's. You know how Ruby's is the nights before Thanksgiving and Christmas. Everyone's there. You can see all your old friends at once without much planning ahead. She'd uncrossed her legs and retrieved her handbag from the floor. I followed her hands with my eyes. I'm aware. What happened next? Let's see. I skipped out of the service during the closing hymn to beat traffic to the bar. I mingled for 20 minutes or so before I spotted Gray and Charlotte and Paul walk in through the front door. She rifled through the contents of her purse. Hunting for makeup, I supposed. Had you been drinking by then? Of course, she laughed, her eyes meeting mine. That's the whole point, isn't it? And what about the others? She returned to rummaging. Not yet. In fact, I bought the first round. What did everyone order? Just as my questions appeared to exhaust her, she finally located the compact she'd been searching for. Retouching her cheeks seemed to renew her interest. Paul asked for a water. Charlotte and Gray both ordered gin and tonics. She paused. Come to think of it, Gray asked me to make hers a double. She whispered it to me like she didn't want Paul to hear, which makes sense. Her last words struck me. Why does that make sense? The compact snapped closed in her hands like a pricey plastic clam. I've heard rumors, she answered, lowering her voice. Rumors Gray might have a drinking problem. My last few encounters with Gray replayed in my mind. The trembling, the wet brow and flushed cheeks. But her husband was missing. That could more than account for anything unsettling about her demeanor. However, I also recalled Charlotte's hesitation on the topic of Gray's drinking. Charlotte's body language had suggested something beneath the surface. How did you hear these rumors? Frances offered a wry grin. In Elizabeth, gossip always trickles back in from the outside world. I'm not exactly sure how I heard. Maybe a mutual friend had gone to visit Gray or bumped into her at a restaurant in D.C. or something, but it fits with Gray's personality. Her personality? Frances spoke matter-of-factly. Everybody goes through that phase, when all of a sudden you don't need your parents out of town to party. We all liked our liquor back then, but Gray liked hers a lot more. When the rest of us began to calm down around senior year, she showed no sign of slowing. I caught her drinking alone more than once myself. Gray Godfrey struggling with substance abuse? That was something new to me. My next question would be a loaded one. I knew why people drank. They drank to get drunk. To think they needed a reason beyond that was a useless exercise. But Frances might not agree, and whatever she filled in the blanks with could be insightful. Assuming it's true. Any idea why she might drink? I asked. The rain that had become so commonplace the past week resumed, spraying large drops on the window behind Frances. I suppose there's the poor little rich girl cliche, but I don't think that holds much water. Her mother might have been a bit cold, and her father often gone, but she always had Charlotte. She hesitated, and I could see the spot of joy her next sentence brought, no matter how hard she tried to squash it. And she had your aunt, of course. Matilda? Tilda. We call her Tilda. I let the slight roll off my back. Frances would get no satisfaction from seeing me react. Why do you think she drinks then? The smile fell from her face. I think Paul drives her to drink. I don't know him well, but he seems awfully controlling, jealous too. He proved it that night. Yes, I was going to get to that. What happened next? Frances answered. Gray left to use the bathroom, innocent enough, except she didn't come back. Everyone else was distracted with Paul's conversation, something political and dull. But I saw where she really went. She went for another drink and took a couple shots while she waited. I flipped a page in my notepad and continued writing. With a man named Jonas Hatfield? I have no idea who he was. Run-of-the-mill white trash, it looked like, she replied. In any case, Jacob excused himself to go to the bathroom, but he didn't go either. He went sniffing for Gray. Paul was oblivious, at first. I know Gray and Mr. Wilcox share a history together. What's your understanding of it? Frances chuckled. History is an understatement. She lost her virginity to him at 13. That's awfully young, I remarked. 13 years old was more than awfully young. It was statutory and unfortunate. Despite my efforts to suppress it, a drop of sadness sent tiny ripples through me. Beneath the line where I'd scrawled the words, possible alcoholism, I wrote, sexually active at young age. Like I said, Gray's personality. Frances leaned back in her chair. I understand they had an encounter that night. Frances's smile and the way she swiveled her high heel under her ankle made it seem like she was enjoying this, like she got off on knocking Gray down a peg with lurid details. On the dance floor. Gray was drunk by then, and if history's any guide, so was Jacob. They made out like a couple barn cats in heat. Mr. Wilcox also has a drinking problem? Jacob has an everything problem. Gray's not the only girl in town Jacob's fucked, she answered through curved lips. He may have his issues, but he's the best cut of meat in Elizabeth. Personal opinion, of course. Of course, I grinned. What sort of problems does he have? She rattled off her answers, rolling her eyes like she'd personally heard excuses for each one. I didn't doubt she had. You name it, he's got it. Money problems, beer problems, pot problems when the beers run out. Lives in a carriage house apartment behind his grandmother's place. On unemployment more often than not. And then there's the jealousy. That word again. Jealousy? She leaned forward on the table. I guess it'd make Paul seem tiny by comparison. Once you're his, you're his. It might fall apart and he might move on. But if he comes calling, you better answer. You were his? I leaned forward too. There was barely more than a foot between our noses now. Yes, she answered flatly. And if he came calling, would you answer? She sat up in her seat, breaking our stare. Like I said, best cut of meat in Elizabeth. But Gray was the original, and she'll always be the one that got away. Not that he ever had much to offer her. And when Paul realized both Gray and Mr. Wilcox were missing together. You mean when I turned Paul's head to the two of them? Each word she spoke was dotted with ire. There was a ruckus on the dance floor the next room over. I couldn't see much, but Gray was so hammered that Paul had to practically drag her out when it was over. I asked my next question more forcefully. Was there a confrontation between the two men? A physical altercation? I told you I couldn't see much, but I imagine there would have been, she replied, picking at the hem of her sundress. Someone important like Paul and someone stubborn like Jacob? Talk about an unstoppable force meeting an immovable object. I set my pen on the table and closed my notepad. Sammy waited for me on the far side of the conference room door. Imaginative metaphor, except now someone's missing. Frances smirked. Then maybe there's no such thing as unstoppable or immovable.
16. Gray. Like riding a bike, I whispered as I made my way to Charlotte's car. Hattie the Catty sprawled her aging body on the gravel by the passenger side door. She purred as I reached down to run my fingers through her tangled black and white fur. Hey, girlie, I cooed. You've got to move so I can leave. She meowed as I picked her up and sat her in the crabgrass a few yards from the car. I'd decided to bring her home with me when all this was over. Let her live out the few days she had left in the comfort of our townhouse. I didn't give a damn what Paul would have to say about it. I pulled the driver's door closed. Charlotte's Benz might as well have been a rocket ship, the way the dashboard lit up. Had it really been so long since I'd driven? Folks knew better than to ask me for a lift anywhere. Even if Paul was certain I was sober, he didn't trust me to stay that way. I slung my bag, weighed down with my laptop, just in case, on the passenger seat. I checked the side view mirror once more for Hattie. She sat perched and alert in the yard, a safe distance away. Exhaling, I pulled the gear shift into drive. As Piper Point's oppressive pillars retreated in the rearview mirror, an emptiness grew inside me. The joy from leaving Piper Point was nowhere to be found, because I wasn't leaving for good. In a few hours, the house would grow large again, swallowing me up on all sides. I turned left onto Adelaide Drive. A high-pitched pinging rang out. My seatbelt, of course. I pulled it across my chest and clicked it into place. I was doing it. I was on my way to meet Paul's Annie. Not Paul's Annie, rather, but the Annie who wanted to help Paul. The woman who wanted to help bring Paul home and ensure he'd be in good shape for the race, too. I had so few allies in life that the idea of finding one so unexpectedly renewed my resolve in more ways than one. 4 days without a drink. The third night was behind me now. No reason I couldn't keep this up. No reason I couldn't keep away from drinking. And then maybe Paul would come home. We'd be on our way, away from Piper Point, out of Elizabeth, old Hattie nestled warmly in a comfy carrier. I'd never look back, perhaps for good this time. The thought made me smile, nothing forced or strained about it. As pines and tall grass whirled by on both sides of the highway, a road sign told me I'd almost reached town. The rain had slowed to a constant drizzle. Not even a drizzle, really. More of a misting. I turned the windshield wipers down. Cirillo sat on the corner of Oleander and Percy, a yellow brick building that looked plain enough, but the barrel-tiled roof made it the most exotic in Elizabeth. As far as food went, it was probably the fanciest, but that bar wasn't high in this town. Most folks cooked at home. Nice meals were usually worth the drive into Charleston proper. None of that mattered. I wasn't here to eat. I was here for answers. My wristwatch was a rose gold and leather piece I rarely wore, but it was important to be on time today. 1:15 p.m. 15 minutes to go. I planned to take no chances with Annie, not when I was finally set to meet her. People ate lunch early in the Low Country, so I pulled into the near vacant lot framed by crooked palm trees. Their green fronds snapped in intermittent gusts, warning of worse weather to come. A couple pickup trucks by the dumpster likely belonged to the wait staff. The gleaming Cadillac, Luca Cirillo's. Annie had probably come from out of town, so I looked for signs of a rental. I found none in the puddled lot. A blonde hostess, no older than 15, parted the door as I half ran up the steps and inside. Following her to a back table, I shook my umbrella dry and removed my trench coat. "Will this be okay?" she asked as she placed a single menu on top of the white linen tablecloth. "Two," I told her. She paused. "Two menus, please. I'm meeting someone here. A friend." "Sure thing, ma'am," she replied, setting down a second menu. I took my seat in the chair she'd pulled out for me. As soon as she'd sauntered off, I concluded this seat wouldn't do at all. For starters, it faced the bar, flanked by row after row of wine bottles. Worse even, I couldn't see the front door. As soon as I'd switched to the other side of the small table, a college-aged guy in a white button-down and black vest approached me, notepad in hand.
"Welcome to Cirillo's," he said.
His dark hair was parted clean down the center.
"Have you ever been—"
I stared blankly at the young man's face in the sudden silence.
"Awkward?" "I'm so sorry, ma'am," he resumed. "You're Grey King, aren't you?"
"Godfrey," I corrected him. "But yes." I shifted uneasily in the lacquered chair.
"Mr. Cirillo will be pleased to know we've got a king in the house for lunch," he said,
a wide grin etched across his face. "That won't be necessary. To tell him, I mean. I appreciate it, but I'm meeting a friend, and it's quite a private luncheon.
He stiffened his back. Oh, we'll make no fuss about it. Can I get you something nice to drink?
He asked, handing me a piece of cream-colored paper. A wine list. I glanced it over from top to bottom out of habit, but I barely stopped to read a word. The young man continued.
We have a 1990 Riesling import on special today. A great price. Goes well with any of the shellfish pastas.
No, I answered tersely. It seemed to startle him, so I softened my voice. No, thank you. I'll have a water, please, with lemon.
You got it, Mrs. King. Godfrey, I mean, he said, scratching my order down. Sparkling or still?
Still, I answered. The waiter snapped his notebook shut with an eager nod and darted off to the kitchen. By 1:35 p.m., I still hadn't touched my water, and I'd told the waiter I wouldn't be ordering until my friend arrived. He brought a basket of buttered bread, but I wasn't hungry. Anticipation squashed my appetite. Come to think of it, I hadn't eaten much of anything in a couple days now. No wonder my pants hung so loose around my hips. Anxiety was likely masking any lightheadedness I might have otherwise felt. I wiped my damp palms on the table linen for the second time. She'd be here any moment. My eyes stayed glued to the front door. The hostess stood at a podium off to the side. Each time the phone in front of her rang, my pulse spiked. Was it Annie calling? Perhaps to let me know she'd be late? No, that was nonsense. She had my number. I checked my phone. No missed calls. Do not let Annie leave here today without getting her number, I repeated to myself.
Mrs. Godfrey?
A voice spoke from behind me. I jumped and turned. The waiter.
Ma'am, Mr. Cirillo asked me to inform you that, regretfully, he had to leave for a family matter. He won't be able to greet you.
He held a tray with both hands.
I said that wouldn't be necessary. I didn't tell him, ma'am.
He frowned.
He recognized you from the galley.
Oh, sorry. The young man's eyes twinkled.
But he asked me to serve you this.
He took a stemmed glass from the tray and set it before me. His motion sent the wine it carried swirling in circles.
The Riesling. On the house,
he announced proudly. Thank you, I murmured, stomach twisting at its pale golden color. Its smell, pungent to my heightened sense. I'm the spider woman of booze. As soon as he was out of sight, I pushed the glass to the empty place setting in front of me. It wasn't worth it. I breathed a deep sigh and eyed the door to the ladies' room. I could pour it down the sink. I started to slide my chair back, but stopped short of standing. Or I could leave it on the table. I'd let Annie have it. Perhaps she'd think it was a show of goodwill on my part. Maybe it would relax her. From how she sounded in her messages, she could certainly use some relaxing. 1:45 now. I turned in my seat and spied a side door. If she parked in the opposite lot, she'd probably come in through that one. As I turned back around, the television behind the bar caught my attention. The picture displayed on it did, anyways. It was Paul. The same photograph from before. The one from the Jefferson Hotel gala. In the bistro's stark emptiness, the voiceover spoke clear as day.
Still no sign of missing Washingtonian Paul Godfrey,
a man's voice announced.
Calls to the King family have gone unanswered, but a source within the police department has confirmed that a crime scene unit arrived from Charleston. They're sweeping the area where Mr. Godfrey's rental car was found abandoned early Christmas morning.
A crime scene unit? My heart seized. Nina never said anything about a crime scene unit. My right hand began to tremble. I grabbed hold of my thigh to still it and released a staggered breath. Protocols, I reminded myself. Nina said the report would initiate protocols. A crime scene investigation would be one of them, no doubt. On the television, Paul's image had vanished. The voiceover continued.
Our D.C. affiliate obtained the following video statement moments ago from Cooper and Waters, Mr. Godfrey's lobbying firm.
A balding Lawrence Cooper appeared, lined face appropriately sullen. He wore a small microphone attached to his pressed lapel, adjacent to an American flag pin. Judging by the granite steps behind him, he stood in front of the firm's building.
All of us at Cooper and Waters extend our thoughts and prayers to the Godfrey and King families during this time of uncertainty. Most importantly, we expect Paul's whereabouts to be uncovered soon, and a speedy return to his wife and family to occur. To my knowledge, there is no reason this cannot happen quickly.
The gaggle of off-screen reporters began to shout questions. I couldn't make out any of them specifically, but I did catch a reference to Mark Stanford, the disappeared politician Nina had mentioned when Mama and I filed the report. Another asked something about when Paul planned to announce his bid. Lawrence pressed on.
I won't comment on or speculate regarding the circumstances of Mr. Godfrey's absence. I will say, however, that Cooper and Waters is doing absolutely everything in our power to facilitate his return. To that end, I'm happy to announce that we have offered our own investigatory services, and the King family has accepted. Our security contractor is traveling to Elizabeth as we speak.
My head spun as blood drained from it. I grabbed the glass of water and swallowed several gulps, the icy cool down the back of my throat offering little relief. Crime scene investigators? Security contractors? Hell, Annie! It was all too much.
Excuse me?
I called to the bartender who'd appeared beneath the television as Lawrence spoke. My voice choked as I did. The woman creased her brow. I must have looked as anxious as I felt.
Yes, ma'am. Is everything all right?
Yes, I answered, words shaky. Just the television. Do you mind shutting it off? She glanced at the screen above her head and back at me, pausing as her mind connected the two.
Oh, yes, of course, ma'am. I am so sorry.
I struggled to smile. Thank you, I said, casting my eyes down to my lap. It was nearly 2 o'clock. Annie was late. Very late. My eyes darted from one side of the restaurant to the other and back again. Where the hell was she? Calm down, I told myself. She's likely not from Elizabeth. She probably got turned around trying to find the place. It's a small town, but it's old. The streets hardly make any sense. My heart beat in erratic fits and starts. The discomfort in my chest grew and spread to my limbs as an itchy tingling. I looked down at my watch again. A glaring red caught my attention. My thumb was bleeding. I'd torn the scab from it without realizing. Christ, my nerves were fraying. Fast. I wrapped my finger in a napkin and looked around for Annie again. When she did arrive, this was no state for her to find me. Trembling and bleeding. It might scare her off. The waiter had lit a tea light candle in the center of the table as he'd announced the day's specials. The tiny flame's reflection on the wine glass, the warm undulations across the curved surface, stole my gaze. It was only Riesling, practically a dessert wine with hardly any alcohol in it. Pushing all other thoughts aside, I reached for the wine and took a healthy swallow.
17. Nina. I drummed my fingers against the pharmacy counter as the technician turned from the rack behind her. She had a freckled face, a redhead in clean white coat. Matilda Palmer, I've got it right here, she announced, scanning the barcode taped to the crinkled baggie. I'll just need your license and your signature. She slid a clipboard towards me. What? I asked.
My thoughts had been wandering from Gray to Auntie and back again while waiting for the refill.
I need your signature and license, ma'am, she answered. It's the law. Opiates are controlled substances.
Right, I replied, collecting my thoughts. Of course. Moments later, I was out the door and on Main Street, Auntie's drugs in the book bag slung over my shoulder. I began the brisk walk to my car through a curtain of icy rain. The station was well within walking distance, but I'd driven anyways. I seemed able to control so little of life these days, but wet socks were entirely preventable. As I approached the corner where I'd parked, a man called my name from the sidewalk behind me.
Nina Palmer?
His tone was as deep as it was snappy.
Detective Nina Palmer?
I turned to see a well-built man in a knee-length raincoat, coal-colored like his slicked hair. Can I help you? I asked. Something about this guy rubbed me wrong. Maybe it was the interruption. Spending my lunch collecting Auntie's meds meant I'd be eating at my desk, if I ate at all. His dress heels clicked against the pavement as he approached. They must have been expensive. He extended his hand.
Andrew Huang, he introduced himself.
His handshake was firm. I had trouble returning the forcefulness he put into it. And am I supposed to recognize your name? I tried to restrain my annoyance. Crow's feet formed in the corners of his eyes as he smiled too wide.